Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the second of two episodes in conversation with Paul Hetherington and Cassandra Atherton about how they collaborate in writing poetry, editing anthologies, and writing critical works about poetry. Plus, the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Paul Hetherington, who recently retired as the head of the University of Canberra's International Poetry Studies Institute, has published 17 collections of poetry, including prose poetry. He refers to Melbourne-based Cassandra Atherton as probably Australia's best prose poet. She has authored and edited more than 30 critical and creative books. Cassandra Atherton and Paul Hetherington together have published collaborative poetry as well as an anthology of Australian prose poetry, A Strange Magic, Australian Prose Poetry from Melbourne University Press in 2020. And in the same year, one of the world's first extensive academic studies of the form, Prose Poetry, An Introduction from Princeton University Press. As we did last week, we'll begin this episode with a prose poem sequence that illustrates their collaborative work.
Eggs after Joe Brainard. Once I ordered poached eggs for breakfast at New York's Malibu Diner, and they gave me two eggs in a cup with no toast. I ate them with a fork, dangling bits of undercooked white.
Once you stole my egg prose poem, you abseiled it over a coffee cup and won a prize for it.
Once I fed plums to your hens, but the broody one looked sideways as if it were an impossibly misshapen purple egg.
Once you told me our love was an egg and our vows a sticky mess, but the next day you cooked me two perfect hard-boiled ovoids.
Once we swallowed prairie oysters, fondly remembering Sally Bowles in Cabaret.
Once you told me you were an identical twin, and I imagined your mother's egg splitting in half and your face smiling out from the left half circle.
Once I bought wine simply because it said, may contain traces of egg.
Once I downloaded the app to track my ovulation, but I decided to go on a pill instead, each pill an undeveloped ovum.
Once you said your thoughts were scrambled, but soon produced ideas like glistening poached whites.
Once a newspaper article stated that someone had fried an egg on railway tracks. Did the train bisect it perfectly like a razor blade, or did the vibration scramble it into a yellow and white stickiness?
Once I saved up my cream eggs at Easter, but months later when I peeled back their foil coverings, their centres were hard-boiled caramel.
Once I read you the line from Macbeth about Lady Macduff's son being an egg, and you took it personally.
Once you pushed back your plate of spaghetti in Lygon Street, telling me you could never eat spaghetti unless it was in a special Roman restaurant. You took me there and smugly held up your plate of pasta smothered in golden yolks.
Once you coddled me like an egg, such low heat and lazy caresses.
Once during water restrictions, I used the egg timer in the shower. I reset it three times before deciding I'd been properly cooked.
Once I made Welsh rarebit with self-raising flour and three eggs, and it puffed up like Hokusai's The Great Wave of Kanagawa.
Once the recipe said not to eat the batter because it contained raw eggs, but I ate a big spoonful, the traces of yolk like a gustery golden ore.
Once you kissed me so tenderly, your lips were like the softest yellow centre. We remembered the avocado and poached egg breakfast at the old paper shop deli.
Once you said my poems were like eggs, and I dreamed of sitting on each of them for three long weeks.
Once you said that our intimacy was a half-cooked egg white, but I refused to follow your meaning.
A lot of people try and work out who wrote each bit, but it actually doesn't work like that, because right. Even within the little bits, someone would start a line and then there'd be, you'd write something else at the end of it. So it's sort of hard to pick.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, the whole idea also around our collaboration, we write some quite serious collaborative poems, and obviously playful poems can be serious as well.
Sure.
But, you know, the collaboration is partly enables a kind of verbal playfulness, which is a back and forth playfulness, which I love because my love of language, my love of poetry, partly came from a joy in the playfulness of language when I was growing up. And my father in particular was fond of puns and very interested in the way language, nuances of language and the way language kind of worked in this slightly disjunctive connection to reality, the stuff we were doing. And I find sort of collaborative work makes some of those, or brings back some of those connections to other people, you know, the playfulness of interacting with other people, mm-hmm. the playfulness of being with somebody else and thinking creatively.
I think of poetry as at least one language art form. And for me, what distinguishes it from strictly prose is that it can be so much greater than the sum of its parts, right? You have these different parts come together, and then it's like a prism and magic happens. And
yeah,
it seems to me then collaboration adds yet one more combination of sort of the unsayable working its magic and adding even one more layer. It would be, I think, almost against the purpose to try and sort out who says which part, because ultimately it has to be a whole.
I think that's 100% right. But it's funny how people want to track things. I think maybe it's human nature to try and say, oh, well, that's about, you know, taking the pill. So, Cassandra, you must have written that because you're a woman. I can't even remember most of the time when things are published who started what. We do keep some of our drafts. I think that will be fun to look at in the future because we do have a lot of, you know, scribbling out and rewriting, and you could probably see who started what idea from some of that. But it's about this magical other thing that happens. It's about, you know, putting your ego away and trusting in the process. And it took me a long time. Like, I'm not somebody who jumps on board that easily with my writing.
Unsurprisingly, Cassandra Atherton said, it's work that requires the building of trust and being comfortable, being frank.
Now he gets an article with track changes down the side, like, this is a mangled sentence, I cannot fix it. And he'll equally do things like, I don't know, do you think this argument holds, or something like that. So we have little tracked comments, and it's nice. You know what I love is when I'm sort of done for the day. I can't write anymore on this thing. I'm tapped out. And I know that I'm sending it, you know, to PH, and he is going to see it with new eyes, and he's going to be energized and working on it while I'm exhausted and getting over that. So it's sort of this amazing ping pong where when one person's done everything they can on it, they send it to the other person, who then picks up and starts again, I suppose, and then sends it back. So it's nice.
Yeah. And there's great things about a natural complementarity, as say about writing styles and so on. But there's equally great things about difference and things that we may agree to disagree about. Mm-hmm. So there's things in the Princeton book that, you know, one or other of us might think, well, I'm not sure we really quite needed that example or that particular page or whatever, or that argument extended quite in that way, relatively minor examples. And we probably both equally feel roughly similar things. But we know that whatever is there, even if we've got the odd little misgiving about it, was believed in by at least one of us. And most of it, like 99.9% of it's believed equally in by both of us passionately. Mm-hmm. And those little moments of discrepancy are wonderful, because collaboration is not about two people actually becoming one person. They're about two separate people keeping their separateness, but hopefully bringing that separateness together. Well, Cassandra said to me the other day, I went the other day, maybe 6 months ago or something, I can't remember when actually, but I still don't think that you maybe should have such and such an example in the Princeton book. And then I said, but your friend from America said that was their favourite part of the book. And she said, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But I think that's how we've progressed because, you know, as I said, we started with the scholarship and then we produced poems on certain themes, which, you know, in some of these prose poetry mini chapbooks, you know, there's a group of people. And then I guess through our editing, we met a lot of international poets and wanted to include them in projects. And I think now writing poems together, so the same poem contains our words in it, is probably, you know, the most overlapping personal step we've taken from that. So I see a progression, and I see it as a progression of trust as well, because I think for me this takes the most trust. And we still, like, he still loves writing about certain themes that are not my favorite to write about, and they creep in every now and then, but they take different paths, and he thinks the same about me too. So he's like, oh, I see where this poem's going, but I'm not going to take it there because I know you want it to be about this. And I'll be like, well, just don't write about your father or memory, because that's not where it's going. And so we have those kind of jokes as well that helps.
And when we wrote the book Fugitive Letters, which is a jointly written book of prose poetry, which is quite a strongly narrative-driven kind of sequence of prose poetry, that was a sort of quite a thrill because, you know, the book, we did quite a lot of planning, but the book then evolved in the writing. And it's a book that I'm actually incredibly sort of proud of, in a way, of having produced. And I'm proud of it because it's a book that is... It is, the voice is that third voice. It's the third voice of our collaboration.
Yeah.
And I think some of the writing in it, I mean, is something I could never personally have it done by myself. And I really love some of the writing in this. I mean, it's one of those books that, you know, like all books, some people might like more than others. But the as a collaborative process, it really made me think hard about, because it's a book length thing, what are we doing here? And what is this process of writing? And Cassandra's got wonderful lucidity about identifying certain issues or problems around, for example, how narrative might or might not be working or whatever. And that's fantastic for me to have put in front of me those issues. And what do I think? And often I think, yes, Paul, you've really got to think harder than you have been.
They related this to their collaborative collection, Fugitive Letters, from Recent Work Press in 2020, about a trove of love letters from the 1930s.
Basically, it begins with this idea of an archive which is accidentally discovered in a house, and it's a sort of a repository of letters that have been left there. And it's set in 2020, that's when the archive's found, but the letters relate to a period long past. There, between rafters, like a nestled rat's hoard or hundreds of stacked insect wings, an affair the size of four shoeboxes. Should I blame the workman for opening the ceiling, or chide him for failing to throw those boxes out? A gaping suddenness that this correspondence might still exist, sketching ghostly stories, throwing old desire into gaudy light. It's a dream woken into day, or some reconstitution of dust. Will the letters vanish if I rub them between my fingers? Meandering sentences drill and rupture time.
Do anxieties relating to self-revelation play a role in collaborations like theirs?
Yeah, I still find it difficult. I have collaborated with people since, not on poetry. As I said before, I find poetry too intimate in a way to share it with somebody or to trust somebody enough to make poetry with them. That's not to say I wouldn't do it in a different form, like having a particular theme and having people write poems, but to me they're solitary poems that kind of connect rather than being collaborative poems. But yeah, I feel that I miss the process with PH when I'm writing with somebody else, because I can't take for granted the things that I take for granted. Mm-hmm. And so while it can be exciting to, like, I have a colleague who I write with academic articles with, and you know, she just has her own set of quirks and her own set of strengths and weaknesses. And sometimes I find it frustrating because I forget that it's taken a long time to get to the point where I take for granted a number of things about the drafts I write, mm-hmm. and that I know PH so well. I mean, one of the things that I've done as a result of that is ask those people to write with both of us. So we've got a number of articles now, haven't we, where we've written with other colleagues that either I work with or you've worked with, and invite them into that process. And that's really interesting too, because they have their own take on the way that we work together, and they think we're quite harsh with one another. They're like, oh my God. And especially because some of them are more junior colleagues, and they say to me, "Wow, did you really say that to Paul Hetherington?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And they're like, "Wow, like I wouldn't say that to him." And I'm like, "No, you have to learn that this is the kind of relationship that you need to have when you're writing with people. You have to be direct and honest." Probably I've got to the point where I'm a little bit blunt when I say it, and we both are with one. It's a waste of words to keep, you know, talking about something where I can just say, "That's an ugly sentence," or you can say, "I bet you didn't copy that quote right out of the book because it's got a dodgy grammar in it." I think that's a really good way of sort of modelling that for other people. And they like writing with us, but they're a bit astounded, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the collaborative writing, so the three where there's another person joins in, you know, it's again another challenge and interesting dynamic. I think three-way things often can be just trickier generally than two-way things, because the back and forth of two-way is, there is that trust. The bluntness that we have, you know, which we take for granted, and neither of us stand on our dignity about anything really when we're working, because we're not at all precious about our work. Mm. We take it incredibly seriously and we want to make it the very best we can, but neither of us think that being precious about it is a way of achieving that. And sometimes, you know, Cassandra said there's been some tears. We had over the Princeton book some really, really tough conversations, probably two or three. Some, you know, these are on the phone, so they're doubly difficult because you're a long way away. But where we're both either upset or angry at the end of it to some extent, because it's actually a really intractable issue, whatever it was we're talking about. And we're really passionately, you know, trying to work out a point of difference. In every case, we did work it out. Mm. And, you know, and that...
You did hang up on me a couple of times. I just called you back, though. That's my irritating response. It's like, just going to keep calling.
It's really important to me that you put everything on the table when you care about something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the end, I mean, if you don't give 100%, and that includes, you know, your passion and so on towards a project that really matters to you, I would say, you know, why are you doing it? You know, what are you involved in? It's not just some intellectual game, not for me. It's about trying to identify and solve hard issues, right. Hard issues. And poetry, I think writing about poetry, whether it's prose poetry, any kind of poetry, and what you were saying earlier, Kimberly, about poetry is, you know, spot on. You know, it is often about those ineffable, unsayable things anyway. So your language, critical language, like the prose poetry book, you know, you're trying to get at and nail things as best you can that you know you can only nail part of.
It seems to me just to have those kinds of moments where you're angry with each other, and then to be able to move past them and still end up with fruitful work, that's how the trust actually develops.
I think so. And I think the anger is never personal. Like, right. It's like, no, I don't believe that about prose poetry. What about these three things, you know? And, you know, you'll come back and say, well, what about these three? And your argument doesn't hold. So it becomes sort of a debate that's not a personal thing. Sure. Although I do remember the first couple of times that we argued about articles or whatever we were writing. And you've said the same to me and I've said the same to you. We both thought, oh, well, that's the end of that relationship. That was like, whoa, he's never going to speak to me again after that argument. And you said the same thing. You thought, well, oh, well. But now, like, I think that's probably nice that we're still as feisty, and we still probably argue about the same or as many things as we always have. But I don't ever hang up the phone and think, well, I'll never speak to him ever again.
But I mean, it's really important. As Cassandra says, it's not a personal difference. No. When I say angry, it's just that you get involved in an idea and you feel that sort of fuming away. So it's probably, rather than anger, it's probably the better thing is it's a kind of a preoccupation with the idea and the kind of intractable sort of seeming nature of that moment where you can't resolve it. But there's been times when I've sort of disagreed with Cassandra on the phone, and then the next day or later that evening or something, I've rung her or texted or emailed and said, actually, no, you were right. You often need to have someone say to you, you are wrong, and say it in a tough way. Mm-hmm. You are wrong. Or if you're right, can you really please think more about this? Because we're all, you know, just working as best we can within our limitations.
Right.
And it's the capacity to expand those limitations that makes, you know, a good collaboration part of what makes it so fantastic.
Does collaborating as they do change the way they work with editors?
Well, that's tricky. I do a lot of editing myself. And I think of editing as collaborative in some way. So I really enjoy editing a lot of PH's solo works. And I enjoy that because, again, I can be really direct and he trusts me and I don't care if he doesn't take on all of my ideas. Like I, as an editor of poetry in particular, I always say, this is my interpretation as a reader. It's very subjective. If I've missed something or if you want to hold on to something, I suggest that you should give away. Please do. I'm not going to be offended. Yeah. And I never go back and look at what he took in and what he didn't. Like, it's just to be kind of helpful. And I do really get engaged with his writing. And so I find that a really kind of pleasurable thing to do. When you're editing for an anthology or there's a competition or something like that, I do try and be quite heavy-handed with editing and ask people to rewrite things. And I always get stunned that they're often not wanting to do that, especially some of the emerging writers. But, you know, I think there's lots of ways of getting published today. And I think there's people who probably have really great ideas about what they want to do with their poems, and it becomes more difficult to make suggestions. But I have noticed with editing that you are not so good editing your own work. You are, to a certain extent, but then he over edits. And so one of the things that I like to do is keep his earlier drafts. And this happened the other day, didn't it? So when PH writes, his process is really different from mine, and that's kind of interesting from a collaborative point of view too. But he does a wonderful edit of his work, and then he gets to a point where it's perfect, but he'll then take out some of the really good lines. And so I like to go back to the early ones and put those old ones back in.
That's, well, you love my milkshake.
That's my favourite line. He had this great line about this guy walking under a bridge with a strawberry milkshake. It was like my favourite line in the poem. And it was there for the first three drafts. And then draft four comes along and sure enough, that's where it's gone. So then I have to track all the things through that. So that's kind of really pleasurable in a different kind of collaboration where I'm your editor. I like thinking of, you know, I don't think that like we're Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot. I'm not saying that at all. But I like to think of editing as more collaborative than some people see it.
Yeah.
You know, I like to see it as really shaping something and having a voice in somebody else's work, not to overtake it by any stretch, but to actually enhance it and give that kind of thing. And I try and do that in even, you know, just the one or two poems that people publish in the journals I edit or in anthologies. And I hope we don't ever lose that. I never mind if someone doesn't want to do it, but I hope we don't get to the point where we just publish without, you know, giving it a good edit.
It's a really interesting thing. I mean, for anyone to have someone who can edit their work well is such a privilege. And yet we're in a culture, literary culture, not just in Australia, but all around the world, where a lot of writers no longer seem to really want much editing. Almost always that means they're not going to be as good as they could be. The reason is that editing is often the difference between a reasonably okay work and a really good work.
Right.
And, you know, you look at a lot of the modernist writers, the important modernist writers, and whether it's Virginia Woolf or D.H. Lawrence, there's a whole list of them who benefited enormously from their editors.
Yes.
And who accepted that editing process? And this is the thing about going back to collaboration that's great. You know, we live in an age where, you know, the individual creativity is kind of being put on a pedestal and there's this commodification of it.
Yes.
And of uniqueness and of creativity and all this stuff that people talk about. But actually all literature is, to some extent, you mentioned intertextuality earlier.
Yeah. Yeah.
All literature is feeding off other literature, other ideas. We don't work in a vacuum.
No.
Writers who think they do are fooling themselves.
Mm.
And collaboration is one way of really getting your teeth into what it is to work with the tradition, with your contemporaries, with that whole business of the fact that literature and language and creative writing is so much bigger than any single writer. Editing your own work is so complicated that having somebody to reinstate the strawberry milkshake is a real blessing.
Yeah.
Because I do have a bit of a tendency, you know, I think I referred to it as gravitas earlier. I occasionally think that there's a quotidian detail, which I love in my poetry and my writing. I care about the quotidian detail a lot, but I think occasionally there's a quotidian detail that should be there and is really working, but I don't fully trust it.
Mm.
And I'm not quite sure why that is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great to have someone say, trust that detail, believe in that detail.
Yes.
Sometimes, Paul Hetherington suggested, this can have major implications for literary writing.
You know, if you look at the history of literature, you know, I think a lot of, not every literary period, but most literary periods in, I think, most countries, they're often not quite so good, but reasonably good writing, and often it's the most successful writing of the era, is overly explicit. And it's overly explicit about the things that people in that particular zeitgeist care about. So if you look at 19th century America, for example, Emily Dickinson could barely get her poems published. She couldn't get them published at all in the exact form she wrote them.
That's right.
And yet there's endless bad, overly explicit, sentimental poems about the death of wives, babies, etc., which were published in the newspapers she couldn't get her poems into, endlessly, constantly. And there are so many of them. If you look back at those newspapers, you kind of think, oh my God, not another poem about a dead baby. I mean, it's really quite shocking how, and yet these poems were so popular, they were over explicit, and if anyone had suggested to most of those writers of those poems, you should edit your work, they would say, why? People love these poems. I'm selling, you know, thousands of copies of these books. Emily Dickinson, you know, edited her work, and it's so complex and so tight, and consequently it took 70 or 80 years before readers really caught up with what she was doing.
Right.
I just think it's a problem in any age is, you know, the best writers know they need an editor to say, you know, yeah, get rid of the stuff that looks like it naturally belongs to this era and is very comfortably coming off your tongue. Think harder, think deeper.
On this and last week's episode of Poetry on the Radio, we've heard from Cassandra Atherton and Paul Hetherington about their collaborations in literary and literary critical writing. Next week, we speak with Shane Strange, poet and director and editor at Canberra-based Recent Work Press. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. On Monday, July 24, at Smith's Alternative at 7 p.m, That Poetry Thing features Us Mob Writing, a group of Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander poets, writers and storytellers based in the Canberra region. They'll present new work from the upcoming anthology Kuraka. This month's reading at Manning Clark House, this coming Thursday, July 27 at 7 p.m, presents three readers. Leslie Lebkowitz's fifth book, Mountain Lion, was published by Pitt Street Poetry in 2019. She has recently edited an anthology of Australian poems about birds with Penelope Leyland. Kathy Kiddaway has published seven poetry collections, five anthologies, a children's picture book, and a four-part radio documentary. Plus, all the way from Castlemaine, Victoria, Ross Donlan. On Sunday, July 30, A Brush with Poetry features contemporary and traditional voices at Bynalong Arts Group's popular open mic event. It's at the Café on Queen Street, Bynalong, at 1:30. On August 5, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m, you can attend a workshop at the University of Canberra entitled Visual Poetry 101 with Karen Florence. The event is hosted by the University of Canberra Centre for Creative and Cultural Research. It's a one-day poetry workshop for people wanting to play with page space and visual ways to experiment with words. For information, look online for the University of Canberra Visual Poetry 101 with Karen Florence. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded Ngunnawal country in the studios of Art Sound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. The music on today's program is from Gabriella Smart's album Chinese Whispers. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atria Musica de Madrid.